And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to you. You get to listen in to some of the most incredible conversations, and today is no exception. Today, I'm going to have a conversation with Melissa Kane Travis. She serves as an assistant professor of Christian apologetics at Houston Baptist University, and she is, and this is really exciting for us at the Christian Research Institute, she's a contributing writer for the Christian Research Journal, our award-winning magazine. By the way, if you have not subscribed to the magazine, you can remedy that woeful condition on the web at equip.org. Melissa is pursuing a PhD in humanities, focusing on the history and philosophy related to scientific and mathematical thought in the Western tradition and contemporary scholarship. She's earned the Master of Arts in Science and Religion from Biola University. She's graduated that program with highest honors. She is certified in Christian apologetics by Biola and holds a Bachelor of Science in General Biology from Campbell University. She was featured alongside her colleagues in the April 2015 cover story of Christianity Today, and she has worked as a bench scientist in the fields of biotechnology and pharmaceutical research after obtaining her undergraduate degree, and has spent more than a decade exploring the science, theology, and philosophy related to the origins debate. And on top of all of that, Melissa is the author of a brand new book, Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God. It is one of our featured resources during the month of June 2018. And so with all of that, I am absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast, Melissa.
Thank you, Hank. I'm so honored to be speaking with you, and I appreciate the invitation.
I had an opportunity to interview Holly Ordway and Nancy Piercy, a couple of your colleagues, and they were incredible.
Oh, I'm sure.
I heard that you got a chance to listen to Nancy Piercy on the podcast.
I did. I'm such an admirer of Nancy, and I'm just honored to be her colleague at HBU. She has done such phenomenal work for Christendom, and I have to admit that I particularly appreciate the fact that she's a fellow woman fighting the good fight.
Yeah, you know, you have Nancy Piercy, you have Holly, you have Mary Jo Sharp, you've got Kristen Davis. And when I thought about the five of you, I thought about the contrast between the four horsemen of the new atheism, you know, Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and Dennett, and what I'm now dubbing the five female superheroes of the neo-apologetics movement.
Oh, I love that. We need a comic book.
You do need a comic book. Collectively, you guys are proof. You're proof positive that women in general and mothers in particular are among the most influential ambassadors, the church in general, and I would say mothers in particular, you are among the most influential ambassadors in the church in developing, reproducing disciple makers today. I think the significance of the hand that rocks the cradle on apologetics and evangelist can't be overstated.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think many who have followed the apologetics world for the past few decades are starting to realize that. We've gone from hearing comments about, well, where are all the women in the discipline, to hearing gracious comments such as yours about, wow, we finally have women in the discipline, and look how incredible this is, especially in influencing other women, particularly mothers, to help raise their kids with a reasonable faith.
Yeah, we've been conditioned to think that apologetics is the exclusive domain of men, and now we can say with certainty that's not the case.
Yes, exactly.
Talk about the importance of mothers teaching their children the essentials of the historic Christian faith. I mean, I am the father of 12 children, seven women, seven girls, and they are incredible apologists in their own right. But a lot of that comes from a mother teaching the children the essentials of the Christian faith.
Yes, absolutely. And when I have conversations with other moms, other homeschool moms in particular, I often sense a great deal of intimidation because they feel as if they need to have formal training in apologetics or read huge stacks of books on the topic in order to be able to teach their children. And what I love being able to tell them is that's absolutely not the case. Think about just having good conversations with your kids about the hard questions surrounding Christianity. And 9 times out of 10, when I'm having these kinds of conversations with fellow moms, it is because they've approached me in a little bit of a panic in response to hearing one of those challenging questions from one of their children. Because often our kids start asking these mind-blowing questions at a much younger age than we expect them to. My older son, who's now turning 15, started asking me questions about the existence of God when he was only 7 years old. And I know that it wasn't inspired by interaction with peers because his only peers were in his little Sunday school class at church at that stage of his life. So this was coming from his own little 7-year-old intellect. And that was a wake-up call day for me because it made me realize that there are lots of moms out there who probably don't know how to handle these kinds of questions. They're underprepared, and they're not doing as good of a job as they actually could do with just a little bit of informal training and self-study. So I like to think of myself as an encourager to those moms out there.
Yeah, and you think about the essentials of the historic Christian faith. I mean, this is what we hang together on. I've said this in various podcasts and broadcasts, quoting Benjamin Franklin, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately. And it's important that we do hang together based on the essentials of the historic Christian faith. And those are essentials that can be internalized and then passed on to our children.
Yes, absolutely.
You make the argument in an article in the Christian Research Journal, the article's titled "What the Size of the Cosmos Doesn't Say About Mankind," but you make the argument that pop science journalism today supposes that the unraveling of geocentrism underscores the so-called Copernican principle, the principle of mediocrity. In other words, if Earth is not a privileged planet, we hear that then human beings that inhabit Earth must not be privileged either. And that's an argument that has to be dealt with today, particularly when you have people like Bill Nye, the science guy, saying, I'm insignificant. I'm just another speck of sand. And the Earth really, in the cosmic scheme of things, is just another speck. And the sun, an unremarkable star. And the galaxy is a speck. And I'm therefore a speck on a speck, orbiting a speck among other specks, among still other specks in the middle of specklessness. And therefore, says Bill Nye, I suck. Talk about how flawed that reasoning is.
So lest anyone say, well, I don't respect Bill Nye as a competent science personality, and I've heard plenty of non-theists make that statement about Bill Nye, we're also hearing very similar comments come from eminent scientists who have become popular public personalities, such as Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who was actually the host of the Cosmos miniseries reboot that came out just a couple years ago and which is entering its second season next year. So there's this idea, as you said, that because we are so small in relation to the rest of the universe, because there's so many billions or trillions of other stars and galaxies and planets out there, then that has to mean that we, by comparison, are insignificant. So the flaw in the reasoning there is that it assumes that value or significance is based on the physical size of something. And that's simply ridiculous. We could use many real-world examples to counteract that very idea. And I believe in the article I use the example of human people. So we would never say that a 50-year-old is more significant than a five-month-old or a five-year-old, right? It's that we are significant and valuable by virtue of the kind of thing we are. So the size of the cosmos in relation to the size of our home planet or the size of a human person is completely irrelevant. But we keep hearing this silly argument promoted over and over and over again.
Yeah, you wrote another article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called A Grand Cosmic Resonance, How the Structure and Comprehensibility of the Universe Reveal a Mindful Maker. And I oftentimes say, quoting my good friend Oz Guinness, that contrast is the mother of clarity. You mentioned Neil deGrasse Tyson. He speculates that the universe just popped into existence out of nothing or is just a computer simulation. On the other hand, you have noted intellects like Albert Einstein who recognize that the materialist view of nature is inadequate for explaining why we live in a universe that is fundamentally mathematical and comprehensible. In other words, Einstein, unlike Tyson, saw the marks of intelligence in the natural order and therefore reasonably supposed that there must be something more to the world than mere matter and motion.
Right. And unfortunately, we never get a super explicit statement from Einstein affirming the existence of a creator God, much less a God who's intimately involved in the affairs of mankind, which is sad. But he hedges right up against it so many times in his writings. He would often say things about the mind or the intelligence behind or pervading the cosmos. He would compare nature to a grand library full of rational information that we're just scratching the surface of. And one of my favorite all-time statements from Albert Einstein was when he said, "It is a miracle that the universe is comprehensible." And if you unpack that statement, you figure out that it really is quite miraculous that the world is structured in such a way that it can be comprehended through the advanced mathematics of theoretical physics, for example. But not only that, but here we are creatures who are equipped with a fine-tuned rationality that can actually do the advanced mathematics of theoretical physics. So there's this wonderful correlation between the mind of man and the physical world such that the scientific enterprise is even possible in the first place.
Yeah, what you say about Albert Einstein is absolutely true. And the point here, though, is that here you have Einstein recognizing that there has to be some sort of intelligence, whether he's a pantheist or whatever his philosophy is, he recognizes intelligence, which is something that Neil deGrasse Tyson won't recognize. He rather defers to this, I think, very obscurantist notion that the universe just popped into existence out of nothing.
Right, right. He believes that something as rational as what we observe, and then human rationality included as a product of that inherent rationality, is just a cosmic accident. So rationality from non-rationality.
And I was reading a quote by British physicist Paul Davies in your article. Obviously, he's very, very famous, well-known, about how true it is that first we determine, as I was thinking about this as I was reading that article, you know, first we determine our paradigms and then our paradigms determine us. In other words, we only see what our paradigms allow us to see. And I think perhaps that explains why Davies, although a very, very brilliant guy, can say that mindless, blundering atoms have conspired to make not just life, not just mind, but make understanding. So his predispositions happen to prohibit him from seriously considering the alternative of intelligence. And so we have to re-examine our paradigms. And I think this is one of the arguments we have to make when we're talking to people in general. You have to examine your paradigm because your paradigm only allows you to see what your paradigm allows you to see. So you're not thinking about your paradigm, you're thinking with your paradigm.
Yes, that's exactly right. The committed naturalist won't, to use the famous quote, allow a divine foot in the door. As far as they're concerned, supernaturalism or theism in general is completely out of the question. And therefore, no matter what kind of observations are made about the material world, they will not even consider the realm of possibilities that include the existence of God or supernatural power. So they rule it out a priori before even looking at the evidence. So I guess a good way to think of it is they're limiting the size of their intellectual toolbox rather than saying, well, let's take an honest look at things and see how things are pointing. Are the findings of science pointing beyond themselves to a higher explanation, or are they not? But if you're ruling out the very possibility, then that's a question you don't even get to ask in the first place.
Yeah, you know, I love the even-handedness of your approach, because you've also pointed out that there are atheist philosophers, Thomas Nagel comes to mind, who is willing to bite the bullet and admit that his rejection of theistic explanations of the world are based entirely on prejudice. I mean, he famously said, I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. So he is biting the bullet. He's recognizing that his predisposition against God is based on a philosophical prejudice as opposed to a scientific argument.
Yes, precisely. So he is one of the very few that I can say are quite honest in their evaluation of the situation we find ourselves in from a cosmic perspective. His book, Mind and Cosmos, is an outstanding example of this, where he talks about the grave insufficiency of Darwinian naturalism to explain what we observe in the world. And so that book has been a huge boon to the project of Christian apologetics, because he makes such great arguments, and he's making them from the perspective of an atheist. But just like you say, he isn't willing to go all the way to theism, and he is honest about the fact that that's because of his philosophical pre-commitments. He prefers instead to speculate about some as yet to be discovered principle behind the universe that makes it tend towards increasing complexity and rationality.
I would imagine that it is comforting for someone like yourself to be free to consider the reality of a personal cosmic mind as the explanation for the exquisite three-part harmony that you've codified in your article, mathematics, human mind, the material world, as opposed to being forced to accept the mindless alternative.
It is. It's so much more intellectually satisfying, because under the naturalistic paradigm, you're just left with this set of brute facts that have no explanation and will not ever have an explanation, because these essentially are not questions that can be answered with additional scientific research. At bottom, they're metaphysical questions about our scientific observation. So the naturalist is just stuck in this rut of meaninglessness and lack of full explanation, whereas the person open to theism has this whole other spectrum of options to pull from. And we are free to say, wow, it seems very much as if mind, rather than blind matter and energy, is the fundamental truth behind the universe.
You alluded to this earlier in pointing out that if you're a 5-year-old or a 50-year-old, it doesn't matter. You have intrinsic value because you are stamped with the imago Dei. You're stamped with the image and likeness of God. And I think that makes all the difference in the world, because you have a person like Stephen Hawking, who recently died. He was very, very, dogmatic in saying that we're just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet of a very average star. Now, if you say that we're an advanced breed of monkeys, you leave open the door for the notion that there are advanced monkeys and there are less advanced monkeys, which is precisely what Darwinism presupposed. I mean, Darwin presupposed a gradation of human races and the lead up to those human races, and therefore he would make statements not only about race, which are hard to repeat in polite company, but also about gender. He would say that a woman can never attain to the eminence of a man in anything she does simply because of her gender. And yet, Darwinists today, they try to separate themselves from it in some cases, but oftentimes he still becomes the icon, the hero. And I find that so interesting in an age of political correctness, in an age in which you can't even make a mistake in a tweet without being absolutely bludgeoned for it. And in a lot of cases, that's exactly what ought to happen, because we ought to never make a racist comment. I mean, it isn't part of the Christian worldview. It isn't part of what Western civilization ought to be about. But yet you have a paradigm that is, as I would look at it, at least, Melissa, implicitly racist.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. If we are going to insist that all human beings are created equal, have equal worth, dignity, and value, then we must have a universal standard in which we're grounding that statement. And if we are not purposefully made in the image of God, that by virtue of our humanity, we are objectively valuable, then there is nothing by which to base this idea of equal value and dignity of human people. And so Darwin was basically being consistent in his view. If we are all nothing more than our biology, and we have certain people that exhibit what we might call preferable biology to another group of people, then that's all we have to go on when comparing them and deciding, well, who's more valuable than whom. So the materialist finds themselves in a very tough spot when it comes to this. J.P. Moreland joked one time, what are we going to do? Say everyone that has a belly button is equally valuable and just judge human value on belly buttons? And he talked about how ridiculous that idea was, but he said it to make the point that we need something much more intrinsic and something that transcends biology in which to ground human value.
I mean, you have luminaries today in the evolutionary community, like Darwin, like Huxley, Thomas Huxley, who, by the way, famously said that no rational man cognizant of the facts believes that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior, of the white man. It is simply incredible to think, he said, that he would be able to compete successfully with his bigger brain, smaller jawed rival in a contest which is to be carried on by thoughts and not by bites. And he's not alone. I mean, I think back to David Hume. I mean, he's spoken of in the most glowing terms by people today. I mean, he was an empiricist philosopher, and a lot of people laud him, but he went as far as to say that blacks are naturally inferior to whites. And as I mentioned, with respect to Darwin, he talked about the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. And when he was talking about races, he was not merely talking about individuals within races. All of this is simply to say, Melissa, I think at some point, this is an argument that should be set forth. I mean, we have to do it with gentleness and with respect, but I think it's an argument that's worth making.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we can point to things like the eugenics movement in Europe and in America in the early 20th century, this idea that we needed to weed out the undesirables or the unfit or the imbeciles of society and purify the human race. Of course, that was behind a lot of the thinking of Nazi Germany. You know, the quote-unquote lower races or the quote-unquote useless eaters of society had to be weeded out because human beings were being looked upon as nothing more than biological machines. And if evolution was going to progress and man improve, then we had to cleanse the gene pool. So we can point to these just incredible atrocities of our pretty recent history to show the impact that consistent Darwinian thinking has had on society.
So how important is it for us as apologists to push these arguments to their logical conclusion? Because a lot of people would be horrified, even philosophical naturalists, atheists would be horrified at the logical conclusions that oftentimes they've never considered.
I think it's very important. I think we have to be persistent and keep doing it. There is always pushback. There's always pushback from the Darwinian materialists who say, just because I'm a Darwinian materialist does not mean that I'm in favor of all the social projects that have been done in the name of Darwinism. And that's a fair point, but what they need to understand is that the logical conclusion of their view yields those kinds of things. So if they want to hold their view, they can hold their view, but they need to know that they're being inconsistent.
I want to talk a little bit about your new book, Science and the Mind of the Maker, subtitled What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God. In that book, you have a moniker. It's called the Maker Thesis. What does that explain?
Okay, so I hint very strongly to the Maker Thesis in the article that just came out in CRJ, A Grand Cosmic Resonance. So the idea behind the Maker Thesis is that the enormous success of the scientific enterprise that we have watched unlock many of nature's secrets strongly implies the existence of a maker. And not only does it strongly imply the existence of a maker, but it implies one who desires to share some of his mind with the creatures. And we would say that because we're made in his image is the reason we are able to share in his mind. So from what we observe, it looks very much as if one of the main goals of the development of the natural world was the existence of rational beings who could investigate its deep structure. And as we investigate the deep structure, we thereby understand something of the mind that seems to be behind it all. Turns out that there are features of the universe in general, and then there are features of planet Earth in particular, that make man's home incredibly hospitable to the scientific enterprise. And to go along with that, we have the kind of minds that are suited to carry out that kind of investigation. And this coincides very well with the Christian doctrine we mentioned earlier of the Imago Dei, the idea that mankind is not just a creation, he is the crown of creation made in the image of God. And as such, we're endowed with these cognitive faculties that allow us to have not just moral awareness, but also higher rationality. So I think using the word resonance, as I do in the CRJ article, is perfect for describing this crazy situation we find ourselves in. There was a 4th century Alexandrian bishop named Athanasius, St. Athanasius, and he's one of my absolute favorite Christian saints. I love reading his work. And he used this analogy that always comes to my mind when I'm thinking about the cosmic resonance behind the Maker Thesis. He said, like a musician who has tuned his lyre, and by the artistic blending of low and high and medium tones, produces a single melody. So the wisdom of God, holding the universe like a lyre, adapting things heavenly to things earthly, and earthly things to heavenly, harmonizes them all, and leading them by his will, makes one world and one world order in beauty and harmony. And I just love that. I think it's so appropriate to the thesis of my book, that when we observe the world and we observe our own nature, we see this incredible resonance that leads us to understand that there is a maker whose mind we are able to tap into just a little bit when we carry out the natural sciences.
I love that you quoted Athanasius. It reminds me of the power of one. I mean, if you think about Athanasius in the fourth century, it was Athanasius contra mundum. It was Athanasius against the world. He was willing to stand against Arianism, and his arguments ended up winning the day. And I also love the fact that he overtly said what many have said throughout the centuries, that God became man so that man might become God. Now, he did not mean that we can become as God is by nature. We are gods by grace. We participate, as Peter said, in the divine nature. But he opened a door which points out just how special we are. We are so special that God has invited us into fellowship within the Trinity. I mean, it's incredible to think that the one who spoke and the universe leapt into existence wants that kind of a relationship with us, a relationship that brings us into the fellowship of the triune God.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And many of the church fathers talked about this very same thing. They talked about how nature is like this grand book. And because we're made in the image of God, we can read that book. We can discern some of his wisdom and power in the things that he has made.
And we think about the Bible, rightly so. I've spent a lifetime memorizing the Bible. But there's also, as you just point out, Melissa, there is the book of nature, and we can see God's imprimatur. We can see his fingerprints on the universe that he has created.
Yes. These arguments actually go pretty far back. They even predate the existence of Christianity. We see roots of these ideas in ancient Greek philosophy, most particularly Plato, and then by 1st century BC, 1st century AD Judaism, we see these ideas about a creator having resonance with the mind of man, absorbed into, or I guess a better word would be inspiring, the writings of Judaism, such that the extrinsic Platonic forms that in Greek philosophy just kind of exist out there somewhere are now placed in the mind of a creator God as the pattern that God used to create the universe. And then our early church fathers come along, and we see the appearance of this wonderful metaphor about the book of nature, the idea that the creation is this communication vehicle by which God reveals himself to mankind. So they saw creation as a natural revelation that could be used in tandem with the special revelation that we find in Scripture. They saw those two in complete harmony and actually synergy, because they thought that by observing the world, we better understand Scripture, and by reading Scripture, we better understand what we're seeing in the world. And then, of course, we see these ideas communicated in both the Old and New Testament. Psalm 19 is a famous one where we read that the heavens declare the glory of God, and they send a message to all the earth. And then in Romans 1:20, St. Paul tells us that God's power and wisdom are so clearly seen in what has been made that mankind is without excuse when it comes to knowing and worshiping him, the creator of all things. And so in the book that I have coming out, what I've tried to do is weave together this glorious intellectual history with the most up-to-date findings of science and the most up-to-date progress in philosophy, and show how these very ancient arguments have not been debunked by the rise of modern science. They've, in fact, been truly vindicated by modern science.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about a quote that I saw in your book, and I actually used it as the quote of the day on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. It was from one of my heroes, Cicero, first century BC. And the reason he's one of my heroes is I used to teach memory for years and years and years, and he was a memory expert, and he laid out some of the principles of mnemonics before the time of Christ. But the quote in your book, "What can be so obvious and clear," said Cicero, "as we gaze up at the sky and observe the heavenly bodies, as that there is some divine power of surpassing intelligence by which they are ordered." Here you have an ancient pagan philosopher recognizing intelligence in creation.
Yes, absolutely. Cicero is one of my favorites too. And I actually discovered in reading Cicero a couple of years ago that he has been totally ripped off by some in the intelligent design community. And I say that very lightheartedly, not to actually point a finger, but you often hear this analogy used in intelligent design literature about detecting intelligence through something called specified complexity. And sometimes the writer will say, imagine taking a handful of Scrabble letters and tossing them up in the air. And when they land down on the table, they spell out a sentence. Now, you wouldn't think that that was by sheer chance. You would think there was something undetectable at work to bring about this information created by the Scrabble tiles. Well, so I'm reading Cicero a couple of years ago, and he's actually the one that came up with that argument, though I've never seen him credited with it. He said, imagine that you have tiles with the alphabet inscribed on them, and they spell out communication. He said, if you saw that, just like we gaze up into the regularities of the celestial bodies in the heavens, so should we see that this ordering is a sign of a higher intelligence behind the world. And I thought that was awesome.
That is awesome. You know, here's a myth that needs to be exploded. The idea that as our understanding of nature has grown, warrant for theistic explanations is shrinking. That's a myth. It's a myth that needs to be exploded.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it's interesting to be in conversation with those that try to promote that myth, because very often they're just using talking points learned on the internet or talking points they've learned from pop atheist literature, and they've never thought about it deeply, and they've never considered the breadth of the knowledge and the breadth of the contributions that the Christian worldview has made to things like the scientific enterprise, for example. So you're exactly right. It's a myth that needs to be dispelled.
Now, you just put your finger on something that I want you to explore a little bit with me, and that is the whole idea of thinking. We no longer think. We pick up bits of information and parrot that information. I'm speaking in a general sense, of course. We parrot that information as opposed to thinking deeply. And part of that is the staccato nature of our culture. I mean, we're getting information at such a rapid pace that we never really get a chance to digest it. I mean, I watch television shows all the time. The interviews are increasingly short. You're coming up to a station break, and then you're on to something else. And because of that rapid fire, people don't get a chance to really think or ponder these very significant issues. So what do you do about that? What do you do as you are working to teach your children or other people? How do you teach them to actually process information, to think deeply about things in an age in which we are being bombarded with information but not really processing it?
That's a great question. It's something that I think about a lot. I was reflecting the other day on the fact that the public school system no longer, if it ever did require, I'm assuming at one time that it did, but at least now they do not require someone to master basic logic before they graduate from high school, which is a tragedy. And that's at the root of a lot of our problem today, I think. But in answer to your question about how do we raise our kids to overcome this ill of society, we have to, well, number one, make sure they're well-versed in the art of critical thinking. And the best way to do that is to teach them what I call the virtue of inquisitiveness. So make sure that when they hear a truth claim, they know to ask, first of all, well, what do you mean by, and restate the truth claim. And the very next question should be, how do you know that to be true? What evidence do you have for that, or what led you to that conclusion? And I have to give credit to my colleague, Mary Jo Sharp, for an excellent study she wrote on this a few years ago. And it's basically an entire book on how to properly question claims of other worldviews. And I think if we can equip our children to just do those basic things, it's a total win, and that they're going to be so much better prepared to face this bombardment of information from the internet and television as they go on through their lives.
Okay, so I think what you just said is so incredibly important, it needs to be repeated. In other words, I think okay. You need to restate what you just said, because people should park on that as they listen to this podcast.
Okay. So I would say the first step is to make sure your children understand the basic rules of critical thinking, very basic logic. It isn't hard to equip them with that. There are some excellent resources out there to help you. But the second thing is to teach them the virtue of inquisitiveness. When they are faced with a truth claim, they need to be prepared to, first of all, ask the person making the truth claim, what do you mean by that? Okay, explain your claim more fully to me, and then teach your child that what they always need to do at that point is repeat it back, make sure they are understanding the claim being made. But then the very next question needs to be, why do you believe that to be true, or how did you arrive at that conclusion? So show me some evidence, or at least trace for me the path of reasoning that led you to conclude that the claim you're making is true. And it will amaze you how many times the large majority of cases in which the person making the truth claim cannot state a reason for why they believe it to be true. And as I said before, I think that that's a huge win right there for someone facing a claim that conflicts with the Christian worldview.
So for those of you listening into the podcast, you want to go back and listen to what Melissa has just said a couple of times and really get that into your head, because I think this is a blueprint for success with your children in an age of information overload. One of the things perhaps in this line of thinking has to do with the late Stephen Hawking, who seems resolutely committed to the notion that philosophy is dead, and as such, questions about the nature of ultimate reality have been ceded to science. Now, that's a claim, and that claim, I think, has to be examined very, very carefully.
Yes. The irony behind it is when he makes the claim that philosophy is dead, that now science is the torchbearer in the path to discovery of what is real, he's making a fundamentally philosophical claim. Unfortunately, for the person who ascribes to the worldview of scientism, they're stuck because science is it's moderated and it's defined and guided by philosophical rules and philosophical ideas. And so we can't get away from it. You can't even make any sort of argument using scientific evidence, an argument for a theory, for example, without using the laws of logic. So it's just an inescapable fact. And it's unfortunate that great minds like Hawking just fall prey to this idea of scientism, that science tells us everything we need to know, that it's the only elucidator of truth.
So here's a classic example of what you said. Here you have someone making a dogmatic assertion, but it's not a defensible argument. You spend a little time thinking about the premise of his statement, and you immediately realize that it itself is dead. It simply does not hold any water.
Right, exactly.
Why is it, in your estimation, Melissa, that post-Darwin, you have scientists who no longer seem to be able to grasp what the ancients did? You mentioned some of them. That if there is mathematical orderliness within the universe, then it stands to reason that this is best accounted for what you called earlier the Maker thesis.
You know, I think we hit on it pretty well earlier when we were talking about philosophical presuppositions. It's really interesting to me to read the counterarguments in the materialist literature against the types of ideas I talk about in my book concerning the mathematical rationality of the cosmos. But on the flip side of that, not just Thomas Nagel, but scientists such as Roger Penrose and Max Tegmark have made the admission that we are looking at a fundamentally mathematical universe, and this cries out for explanation. But again, they're locked into their philosophical pre-commitments, and they are not willing to entertain the idea of the existence of God. So it's just a very interesting dynamic, and again, I just have to say, in my estimation, it always boils down to those philosophical pre-commitments.
You know, I love hearing what you have to say. I think about, again, as I mentioned earlier, and my audience well knows, I'm the father of 12 children. And those children, when they went to school, we happened to put them all through a Christian school. In fact, I was just at our youngest child's eighth grade graduation just before I came in to do the podcast. And they have been in a very favorable situation because when they have questions, they know that they have someone to come back and ask those questions to, as opposed to those questions throwing them or drawing them away from the Christian worldview. And in that sense, I want you to maybe expand on how important the discipline that you're involved in with Nancy and Holly and the rest, how important this discipline really is, how important it is for mothers, not just fathers, but maybe even particularly mothers to have a grasp on basic apologetics, because this is the inoculation process against what their children are going to face in school and in the workplace.
Well, I think that all of the women out there listening who are mothers themselves already know that it is typically the case that we spend more time with our children than any other person does while they are in their formative years, before they get their driver's license and start spending all that extra time with their friends, or they graduate high school and go off to college. So we have them from birth as this captive audience, this little sponge that just absorbs so much from our words and from observing our actions. And because we're the ones that they're around most of the time, we happen to be there when these big, hard questions occur to them, or when they hear a big, hard question from a peer at school, or when they hear a claim made against Christianity in a television show, or when they see someone make a statement on social media that goes against a core Christian truth claim. And so we have this golden opportunity to do conversational learning with our kids. And through having these conversations and not going into panic mode, we can show them that our faith is reasonable, our faith is credible, that we have great answers to the challenges that are often hurled at Christianity from secularists in our society today. So we serve as this educator, whether our children are educated at home or in a conventional school or what have you, we are educating them from birth on how to view the world. And part of their instruction on how to view the world is how to understand themselves in the context of the core Christian truth claims and in the context of a broader society. So they're learning all those things from us. And not to say that dads aren't key teachers too, but as I said before, the case is usually that the mom is around the children for the majority of the day during their formative years. So we just have a really special opportunity to raise up warriors for the kingdom.
But you have to make time for that. And as you've pointed out somewhere, I remember reading about you talking about, I think it was in your Motherhood and the Life of the Mind article in the Christian Research Journal, that you can take a half hour that you might be watching television, or you can take the time in which you're driving your child to school and use that time efficaciously for the purpose that you just outlined.
Oh, absolutely. I often have moms say, well, I need to do some preparation before I answer these hard questions, and I just don't have time to sit down and read stacks of books, which I totally get. And I explain to them, look, you have to fold laundry, you have to cook dinner, you have to drive your kids to school and then drive yourself back home, or then drive yourself to your job or what have you. Take advantage of those windows of time to listen to excellent podcasts, to listen to excellent audiobooks, and just gradually start building your knowledge base and start with the basics. And you'd be really surprised at how much progress you can make by just using those snippets of time in your regular daily routine to better prepare yourself. And I love it when I hear moms come back and say to me, you were totally right. I was able to listen to this audiobook on this day while I was cooking dinner. And wouldn't you know, 2 weeks later, my seventh grader asked me a question and I knew how to answer it. So I like to say, look, let the Holy Spirit be your guide as you're learning, and you will discover that there is a purpose behind it sooner or later. And that has always been true with me and the kinds of questions my kids have come up with, and I've watched it happen over and over again in the lives of families in my community with whom I've interacted. So
I think Melissa, I think what you're saying is it's not a matter of time, it's a matter of priority. I mean, we all have time to eat, we have time to sleep, we have time to get involved in our, you know, in our favorite pastimes. It's not a matter of time, it's a matter of priority.
It definitely is. And it doesn't take a whole lot of sacrifice to make room in your life for some high quality learning. And I think once you get the ball rolling, you learn how to better fit it into your routine, and you realize, hey, I had more time than I thought I did. I just had to give up some things that were a whole lot less important than this.
And I can tell you from personal experience, I mean, my wife is absolutely amazing. I think she's a superwoman. She's not only done many of the things that you've articulated on this broadcast, but in addition to that, she's a voracious reader. When I contracted cancer, she knew more about my circumstance, my cancer, than I even do at this point. When I converted to Orthodoxy, she bought literally hundreds of books on Orthodoxy. And they're not just books, they're stacked up. I go through those books and I see that they're underlined and there are little notations on each page. So it is amazing what you're able to do if you put your mind to it. And I think my wife is a great testament to that, as of course you are.
Oh, I appreciate that. I love hearing that about your wife. We need more like her. It's absolutely true. And I love when I see women catch the excitement of learning for the glory of God, because there are few things I would say that are as exciting and fulfilling as expanding our knowledge in order to build up our own faith and to build up the faith of our kids. There's just nothing that parallels it.
I want to spend a little time cashing out the handle I gave you, along with your cohorts, Nancy and Holly and Mary and Kristen. I've dubbed you the five female superheroes of the neo-apologetics movement. I want to cash that out a little bit with you. The first thing we talked about is you're females. And so you're setting an example for other females. I mean, obviously, apologetics is not about gender, but you are breaking some barriers here. It's very, very important for us to elaborate on those broken barriers.
Yes, I agree.
So do that for us. I mean, so I see you on the cover of CT, and I think, wow, there's a picture. That picture is a model for what it kind of lets you know what is possible. Because, you know, Nancy, in the podcast I did with her, she was talking about how women are really being ripped off. They're being ripped off because they've been sold a cultural narrative, and they're squeezing themselves into that cultural narrative and forgetting that there are a lot of other avenues that can be explored and explored in your own time rather than the time that the culture is forcing on you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the fallout from that Christianity Today article that featured the five women apologists, my colleagues at HBU and I, it was so encouraging, the number of emails that I got from women who said, I had no idea that it was possible for women in my stage of life to pursue something like this, especially a theologically oriented discipline. And they were very encouraged towards pursuing at least some self-study of their own, but some of them even started investigating going into a graduate program. And I would often get questions, wow, can I really do this with children at home? And I told them, absolutely. When I entered my master's program at Biola to do the science and religion program, I had a six-year-old and a three-year-old. So I know firsthand exactly what it's like to balance those two things. It is a challenge, but it is doable. And I never felt that I had to sacrifice the really important things in my family life in order to make room for my learning. And the wonderful benefits have been not just being able to have these awesome, deep conversations with my children about theological and apologetic topics, but also being able to model, both of my kids are sons, being able to model for my sons what it looks like to be a woman who loves to learn. So not only am I modeling an adult who loves to learn, but I'm showing them what it looks like to be a mom who loves her family, who loves the Lord, who wants to keep her priorities straight, but who also makes room in her life to be a Christian intellectual. And I think that that will serve them particularly well when it comes time for them to choose a wife in the future. In all these different ways, I think the female apologists who have emerged on the scenes now are doing such great things in Christendom. You know, we're showing that a lot of the stereotypes are false, and we're showing that we don't want to be restricted by what you were just talking about, these cultural narratives for what it is and is not suitable for us to do at any given stage of life. I'm grateful for my colleagues. I am honored to be numbered among them. I love the work that we're doing. I love how we're able to encourage one another. I hope that, as you say, we serve as role models and examples for the other women out there who sense that there can be much more to Christian life, meaning much more to the life of the mind, that can build them up spiritually and equip them to better raise their kids.
And I love particularly what you were just talking about with your own children. You had your children, you didn't do, and Nancy, again, talked about this in the podcast I did with her. A lot of women, they're forced into this mold where they put off having children until they're older. Then in the process, they are using carcinogenic kinds of products to keep children at bay, as it were. Then later on, they're using fertility products to try to get pregnant. And so they're sort of trying to fit a pattern that might not be the best pattern. Rather, you have gone with a prototype or a pattern, which is far better, where you have the children. All the while, you have that benefit of being a mother, being a superhero to your children, being a model to your children, and yet being able to pursue a very, very worthwhile career.
Yes, it has not been without its challenges. It's sweat and tears, and there's probably some blood in there along somewhere. But at the end of the day, it has been incredibly rewarding. I would do nothing differently. And as I said, I have never felt that I had to sacrifice the really important aspects of my family life. And I'm very glad to have had my boys at a younger age, and to be able to learn and model learning as they're in their formative years observing me as an adult. So I think that it's been a win-win, and I hope more women will consider the fact that all of the education and career attainments do not have to be behind you before you can start considering having your children. You know, they're a wonderful asset, especially from a spiritual perspective. I mean, my kids, when you're having to stop in the middle of a term paper writing session to change a diaper, you know, reality hits. And it's such great spiritual formation, in my opinion. It keeps you humble, and it reminds you of your life priorities for sure.
We live in an extraordinary time, and this is a time in which we have to have superheroes. We have to have people that are modeling for us what is possible, because it's so easy when you look at what you described as scientism and philosophical naturalism. You look at the cultural narratives and you throw up your hands. There's no hope. How in the world can we change the culture? And yet we can. There is, as you pointed out, the power of one. You think about Athanasius. Athanasius stood at a time when it was not popular for him to stand, and yet he stood on the deity of Jesus Christ. He stood against the Arian heresy. The Arian heresy at that time was enormously popular. So he today is an icon in our minds, in your mind, my mind, in the minds of many, many people. So in this age in which there are such ferocious difficulties for the Christian worldview, in which the whole Christian worldview is being upset, in which we're living not in the pages of the Bible, but the shadow of the Bible, this is a time in which we can as yet make a difference.
Yes, it absolutely is. We're dealing with idols today, and these are idols that have been around for millennia. I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, right, when it comes to these false ideas that are raised against the kingdom of God. And so we're in what Lee Strobel has called the golden age of apologetics. We have some of the best philosophy and scientific evidence at our disposal now. So we should be able to face these cultural idols, things like scientism and materialism, with the biggest guns we've ever had. We just need people to rise up and be willing to equip themselves to do it. And I think it's a very exciting time. I am not discouraged at all by what I witness in the culture. I see a lot of things that are angering and saddening because I know how much they break the heart of God. But I also know that we're in an era where we can wage war against these false ideas in a stronger manner than ever before. And so I am just thankful that the Lord saw fit to call me into this kind of battle because this is where I thrive.
I want to go back to the moniker of the five female superheroes of the neo-apologetics movement. I want to park on that word neo-apologetics. There's such a thing as Darwinism, there's neo-Darwinism, and I think there's a distinction that can be made with respect to apologetics in the past and apologetics in the present. Oftentimes, and I have noted this over the years, apologetics in the past has been about winning arguments, using hammers, demonstrating your mental acumen, as opposed to winning the person. And I've seen a big change in a lot of younger apologists. I can say younger apologists because I'm now almost 68 years of age. And they're more keen about winning people than winning arguments. And I think that emphasis needs to be underscored in red.
I absolutely agree. And I will have to confess here that this is a lesson that I learned the hard way. When I was an early 20-something and I was first introduced to the discipline of apologetics, it was through the writings of some of the very, very big old school apologists. And so I wasn't about laying out an argument graciously with gentleness and respect. I was about winning an argument, and that's all that mattered to me. I wanted to win the argument anytime I was in a discussion with someone who did not agree with the Christian worldview or who disagreed with the central truth claim of Christianity specifically. And so over the decades, I have learned in the beginning the hard way, and as time went on, learned through observation of some of the what you're calling the neo-apologists, that apologetics needs to be, by necessity, a holistic discipline. We have to minister to not just the minds of those who need Christ, but we need to be ministering to them emotionally. We need to be ministering to their imaginations. And I think my colleague Holly Ordway and her work in imaginative apologetics is really leading the way in a beautiful manner where apologetics and the imagination are concerned. So it's not just about, hey, my argument squashes your argument, or I've won the debate that I've had with you. It is really about opening the person's mind to the person of Jesus Christ. At the end of the day, that is always the goal. And pounding someone over the head with a hammer, so to speak, is never going to accomplish that. And I am very grateful that in this neo-apologetics movement that we have today, that lots of eminent apologists have made these kinds of connections. And the work that's being done now is better than ever before, I think.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely true. Talk about the organization of your book, Science and the Mind of the Maker. Reading through it, I was thinking, you know what, this is very, very accessible. It's the kind of book that I want to put in the hands of people because, again, accessibility is so important. We talked earlier about the fact that we live in an age of information overload. I have stacks of books that I have to read every single week. And the information overload just drains you after a while. And so I really see books as very, very important when they're laid out in a way that's accessible. And one of the things I liked about your book in particular, Melissa, is how you have the bullet points at the end of the chapters.
Yes, I myself am a big fan of bullet points, so I was very grateful to my editor that he allowed me to include those in all of the chapters, because I find, especially when, like you said, you have a lot of reading material to get through, a lot of reading material you just want to get through even, you need a constant refresher. I can't remember what the term is. I think it's called spiral learning, where you're introduced to ideas, the ideas are elaborated upon, and then when you get to the end of the chapter or the essay that you're reading, the author says, okay, after all of this, here are some key points that we need to highlight. And it just helps solidify in your mind what the most important takeaways are from the chapter or essay that you just read. So my idea for the book was, number one, accessibility to a lay audience. When I was first approached to write the book, I was a little worried that they were asking me to write something that would just be one more dime a dozen science and faith books. There are tons and tons of science and faith books out on the market. I've read most of them. But my editor said to me, look, here's what our target audience is. We want to make this kind of information much less intimidating to the average Joe in the church pew. We're talking about people who would never in a million years pick up a book written by someone like Bill Dembski, right? People that are just intimidated and shy away from that kind of writing or that level of writing. So what we want you to do is pull the strings together and write it as sort of a gateway book. You know, bring up lots of different topics and treat them fairly and thoroughly, but do so in a way that the person who's hearing about these kinds of arguments for the very first time can say, oh, yeah, I really get this. So I agreed to write the book, and I kept that goal in mind all throughout my writing process. But one of my personal passions in the science and religion discipline is the history behind all of the things that we talk about. So what I did was, in the book, I'll have a chapter that talks about an argument based on scientific evidence and philosophy. But then in between that chapter and the next such chapter, I've offered chapters that cover some of the intellectual history that's related to the arguments that I'm giving. So it's a very interdisciplinary book, and it's only right at maybe 210 pages long, I think. So the reader is getting a great introduction, not only to the philosophical issues that are at play in the science and religion debate, but also some of the science from biology, from cosmology, from neuroscience, and then some of the history. I talk about ancient Greek philosophers. I talk about the early church fathers, the giants of the scientific revolution. One chapter that was particularly fun for me was talking about the physics revolution of the early 20th century, where I got to explore Einstein and Max Planck and Arthur Eddington, and the things that they would say in their writings that are extremely friendly to the Christian worldview of the cosmos. So my hope is that the quote-unquote average Joe in the church pew, the person who has maybe never delved into this issue of science and Christianity or science and religion more generally, will be able to pick this up and feel intellectually challenged, but not challenged to the point that they give up. You know, I want them to be able to digest the information and to be able to have really good conversations with their kids and their friends and their colleagues about what they've learned.
You mentioned Bill Dembski, and I think that brings up another issue, and that is, I think that it's important for someone like yourself to do top apologetics, to digest books by Bill Dembski that might not be accessible to the average person, although he has written some accessible things for the average person as well. But it's important for someone to do top apologetics so that you can do pop apologetics or popular apologetics. Because if you don't get it at the top level, then oftentimes what you're writing at a popular level is full of very easy to explode myths or holes or contradictory thoughts.
Yes, that's true. So the fine line that we have to walk is bringing it down to a level that's accessible enough that the reader grasps the arguments, grasps the information you're trying to convey, but we can't do that to the extent that we're giving them just enough information to make them dangerous, because that's where we get a whole lot of the poor arguments that float around and just will not die, much to my chagrin, in the popular Christian community.
What do you think about, maybe this is too controversial a subject, but you think about the age of the earth issue. I mean, it took me a long time to write about this myself, but it seems to me oftentimes that that issue alone is critically important. Now, obviously, it's not an acid test for orthodoxy. It ought not divide us as Christians. But on the other hand, I see kids that go to school, they immediately realize the implausibility of a universe that's 5,000 years old, and they make the leap of logic that that's what the Bible teaches, and therefore the Christian worldview no longer holds up in an age of scientific enlightenment. It's a sophomoric way of thinking about it, but oftentimes that's the connection that's made.
You're absolutely right. I have a dear friend who works with students at Rutgers University. She is an apologist. And she runs an apologetics organization right there on the campus of this very, very secular university. She has students from many different worldview persuasions attend these meetings where lectures are offered from Christians who are in either apologetics or a related academic discipline. And one of the things Julie has said to me time and time again is that she sees these students come in as freshmen, these students who were raised in a Christian home. We might use the word, not that I like using this word, but we might use the word fundamentalist Christian homes. So they come into the university with this idea that if the young earth paradigm isn't true, then Christianity as a whole cannot possibly be true, because they have been taught, whether by well-meaning parents or well-meaning teachers, that the only biblical view, that's the word that's always used, the biblical view is the young earth paradigm. And so when they enter these college courses where they're presented with information that leads them to conclude the young earth paradigm cannot be true, then their faith is shaken to the extent that many of them just walk away, or they have a crisis of faith that lasts for years before they're able to come to some sort of reconciliation in their own mind. So I think the lesson to be learned from that is to be so dogmatic on a secondary issue or subsidiary issue when it comes to talking about the compatibility of Christianity and the natural sciences does a whole lot more harm than it does good.
And in all fairness, I think it should be pointed out that there are some incredible people in the young earth camp that they don't make this an acid test for orthodoxy. Think about Paul Nelson, for example.
He's
just extraordinary. Yes. Everything he does is fantastic, and he does it in a very winsome way. But again, on the other side of the issue, you have so many that are making this an acid test for orthodoxy, and because they do, I think they create a tremendous amount of uncertainty, I think cognitive dissonance, and as well, maybe controversy within the church that's unnecessary. I mean, I've often said controversy for the sake of controversy is sin. Controversy for the sake of a divine imperative is a divine command. That's not original with me, but, you know, you just don't want controversy for the sake of controversy.
Yes, yes, I totally agree. I'm a huge admirer of Paul Nelson and his work. As a matter of fact, he was one of my lecturing professors in the science and religion program at Biola, and he gave the lecture to us that went on to inspire the Illustra Media production Metamorphosis. And I was so just enamored with this argument from butterfly metamorphosis that I actually went on to write a children's book based upon his argument. So he is for sure one of my intellectual heroes. And I couldn't agree more with what you've said about his gracious approach to holding the young earth view. But yet when he does his work, whether it's speaking or writing or what have you, he's so gracious and he doesn't make it the central issue because he knows the overarching question of the existence of a creator, for example, is far more important. And it's also more useful to promoting the gospel than getting bogged down in debates about age of the earth and so on and so forth.
As one of the great role models in apologetics, just period, I with you, just love the Illustra series. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. Led Allen, what he's done in that particular sphere with these DVDs is just absolutely incredible. But you touched on something, and I think I'm going to close the podcast with that. You touched on your children's apologetic series, and I can't think of anything more important than that. Elaborate.
Oh, yes. So one of my very first projects, I was actually still a student in my master's program when I pitched this project to Apologia Educational Ministries. And it's a 4-book series entitled The Young Defenders Series. And each of the 4 books deals with a different tough question and different argument for the existence of God. And 2 of those books deal with science and faith issues. The very first one is entitled, How Do We Know God Is Really There? And it's a fiction story. The main character that runs through the series, his name is Thomas, named after Doubting Thomas, the apostle. And he asks his dad to explain to him how we can really know that God does exist. And it's a kids level presentation of the cosmological argument for the existence of God. And then the second book is the one that's based on Paul Nelson's metamorphosis lecture. And it's called How Do We Know God Created Life? So it's all about the character of Thomas going to an insect exhibit with his mother, who happens to be an entomologist. And he starts asking questions about some of the information cards he's reading at the museum. And he's wondering, well, could this have all really been an accident of nature, Mom? How do we know that God had a hand in creating living things? And then the other 2 books, one addresses the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, and it's entitled, How Do We Know Jesus Is Alive? And then the final one addresses the moral argument for the existence of God, and it's entitled, How Do We Know Right From Wrong? And it delves into the problem faced by materialism of not having anything to ground their ideas of right and wrong, good and evil in. So that's my little 4-book collection. I felt like those were probably the most essential apologetics topics to introduce kids to at a young age, somewhere between the ages of 7 and 10, I'd say.
Well, Melissa, you are amazing. I just loved having this conversation with you. I know it's going to help a lot of people. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
And Melissa Kane Travis, she is, as I have dubbed, one of the 5 female superheroes of the neo-apologetics movement. And she is in keeping with what we do on Hank Unplugged. We bring some of the most interesting, inspirational, informative people on the planet directly to you in candid conversations. And the ratings we're getting on Hank Unplugged are simply incredible. We got a 5-star rating from Chase, who says, Hank, thank you for your commitment to Christ. It is so great to have this podcast in addition to the Bible Answer Man broadcast. We're praying for you. Another by Kesis, I think that's how you pronounce the name, who says, simply amazing. It is a deep theological discussion with Christian love. Dear Hank, may God bless you and your ministry. One more by Dare to Ref. Hank's podcasts cover topics that every person, Christian or not, can learn from. It's good to hear truth in these times. So if you enjoyed this podcast, go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, give the podcast a review. This is a way in which you can take an action step by which the podcasts are available to people around the planet. So also share. Share what you have heard. Encourage other people to listen to the podcast. Some of these podcasts have got all the way to number 6 in the religion space, which is amazing. And that's a direct result of people going to iTunes, giving a 5-star rating, reviewing the podcast, and sharing the podcast with other people as well. You've just finished one of the significant Hank Unplugged podcasts that will make a difference not only for time, but also for eternity. The resources that we talked about on the show, including Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God by Melissa Kane Travis, available to those who support the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can check it out on the web at equip.org. Again, this is not for purchase. It is simply when you support the ministry, we're more than delighted to put this book into your hands. We're also going to start featuring Melissa's child series that she just talked about, the series for children, the apologetic series. I just wasn't as familiar with this series as I should have been, but I'm looking forward to remedying that woeful condition so that people can get this series as well. We'll be talking about that and featuring that on equip.org in the very near future as well. Once again, my thanks to Melissa Kane Travis and my thanks to you for tuning in to Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.